Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Casey Sepp, who is out with a brand new book, Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. And I've got to tell you, this thing is, you've heard of nonfiction thrillers. This is a nonfiction thriller. It is a page-turner. Casey, this book, you've got it really separated into three parts. You're talking about a minister, you talk about a lawyer, and of course the writer, Harper Lee. But take me back to where this book is actually set. Alexander City, Alabama. Set it up for us. What would we see if we went there?
Sure. Well, what you'd see today would be a little different than what you would have seen in the 1970s when the book is set, or even in the 1920s when it begins. But you'd still see kind of the main natural features, Lake Martin, and it's one of these incredible southern man-made lakes. They dammed the Tallapoosa River and flooded tens of thousands of acres to make this lake that would fuel the region with hydroelectric power. And so you would see that, and it's a beautiful lake surrounded by beautiful pine forests, and you know, around the edges of it are these tiny towns, and then you'd make your way to Alexander City, which was really the kind of economic engine of this region. And, you know, those were textile mills that were thriving, you know, from the 20s to the 70s and into the 80s and 90s. But then, you know, a lot of that textile mill work moved to Latin America. So it's a little bit of a different town today than it was when Harper Lee was there covering this case. But you'd still find, you know, a charming southern town with great places to eat and, you know, interesting happenings at the local courthouse. And, you know, the busiest places in town are still the churches.
I've read tons of southern literature, and it seems like the South always has its secrets and they remain buried forever. But we'll get to Harper Lee in a second. Reverend Willie Maxwell, very, very interesting character who I had never heard of before this book came out. Who was he, and how did he become a reverend?
Sure. So Willie Maxwell was born in 1925, right around the time Lake Martin was formed. And, you know, he's the son of a sharecropper and a housekeeper. And he grew up the way that a lot of young African-American did in this part of the South. And he was drafted into the Second World War, came home, went to work at that textile mill we were talking about. But around the edges of that mill work and some quarry work, he was recognized at an early age for his ability to read scripture and charismatic preaching, and he was ordained by a Baptist church, did a little bit of ongoing theological education at Selma University, but he was just well known for his preaching and, you know, had the kind of itinerant country circuit we don't think about as much anymore, but a lot of these part-time Baptist ministers did something, you know, Monday to Friday, and then they were working different pulpits on a Sunday, and that's how the reverend became known around Lake Martin. It was his sermons and his preaching and his eloquent speech. He also really had, you know, the kind of sartorial taste that gets you well known too. And so in an area where there's this kind of modesty and, you know, plain clothes, he was known for these three-piece, you know, tailor-made suits. And that was his public persona. And he wore those basically any time, not just in the pulpit. So he was very recognizable around town.
And it seemed like he was a very dangerous man to know because people around him started dying at some point, right?
Yeah, so his first wife was found murdered in 1970, and he was tried for her murder but not convicted, partly because a neighbor of his who was going to be the state star witness changed her testimony. And a few months after that trial, he married the neighbor. So the second Mrs. Maxwell had participated in the trial for the murder of the first, and not long after that marriage, she was found murdered under similar circumstances. And same was true for a nephew of his, for a brother of his, and then in 1977, a stepdaughter of his was found murdered under similar circumstances, too. And the reason that rumors spread, you know, some people thought maybe he was just Job and these were trials he suffered, but a lot of people knew about the life insurance policies he held on these individuals, and they refused to believe that, you know, someone could suffer so much coincidentally. They believed that, in fact, he was responsible for all of these deaths.
I have a police officer friend of mine who always uses the phrase, there are some murders, there's no perfect murder, but some are good enough. That was kind of what was going on here, because other than the first one, nobody had ever considered these homicides, right?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the police suspected homicide, but of course a homicide charge has to follow from a finding of homicide, and In the case of a lot of these deaths, the criminology work did not support that finding. And in some of them, even, there was never a cause of death determined. So they really were unexplained, suspicious. You know, the police definitely thought he was involved, but of course, I'm sure your law enforcement friend would tell you, there is, you know, a country mile between what you suspect and what you can prove in a court of law. And in the case of the Reverend Maxwell, those suspicions did not add up to criminal charges, much less a conviction.
So he had life insurance policies on all of these folks, and your book does a great job explaining the history of life insurance in a very, very interesting way. But Big Tom Radney, an attorney in town, he's another main character in the book. He spent a lot of time representing Willie to try to collect on these policies. So what was Big Tom Radney's reputation among the town?
Sure. I mean, I think that hopefully the experience people have reading Furious Hours is meeting these characters, and certainly Big Tom is one, you know, he's larger than life. And he had had a thwarted career as a liberal politician during the Wallace years, you know, the Kennedy ban, and supported the federal government and wanted to raise taxes to make better schools and better roads. So, and was pro-integration. So, of course, he wasn't very popular in his political career, ended pretty quickly. But in terms of his legal career, he was well-known as a trial lawyer, and that was not only with criminal defenses, like the one he offered the Reverend over and over again, but he was also a very aggressive civil litigator. And again, for the Reverend, that meant that even when these insurance companies didn't want to pay up on the policies, Big Tom would take them to court, and, you know, over a dozen times he prevailed in these civil trials where he and the Reverend were able to recover the life insurance funds. So the history of life insurance is just to kind of set up how an operator like Reverend Maxwell was able to take out all these policies on different individuals, many of whom don't even seem to know he held insurance on them. But, you know, Big Tom was integral to that. You know, you needed a good lawyer who could go around to these circuit courts and go all the way up to the district court and the Court of Appeals in Alabama to prevail in these civil cases to get the money.
Well, I think Big Tom even made a comment that you attributed to him in the book that he's worn out the juries in the county there with Willie Maxwell.
Yeah, that's a letter he wrote to a friend of his in Montgomery County, and he's basically trying to ask that friend to bring cases there. You know, he was still trying to collect on four $1,000 insurance policies. So again, a lot of these were smaller denominations that added up to about $500,000 in today's dollars. But at that time, he felt like he couldn't bring another case in Coosa or Tallapoosa County where the Reverend lives and where he lives. So he was writing to a law school friend to say, hey, would you mind, you know, I'll give you a cut, but I need some fresh juries. Would you mind, you know, bringing these actions? And he told him his legal strategy, which to that point had prevailed.
Well, and Tom Radney represented Willie Maxwell, obviously, throughout all of this. What was their relationship like? Was this strictly an arm's length business guy, or were they friends?
Boy, I mean, I think you'd have to ask lawyers how they feel about any client. I would guess that friendship is sort of the rare relationship. And I think one of the things that's important to remember about Tom Radney is, you know, he came of age in an era where there was real animosity towards African Americans in the community. And in his case, he was happy to represent his black neighbors and whatever lawyering they needed done. So part of, I think, his prerogative in this instance was here was a man who needed a lawyer, and it's not a lawyer's job to ask questions, certainly when it comes to a criminal defense. But, of course, the scrutiny around town came when over and over again he was helping the Reverend collect money. And so, you know, his reputation became quite sordid, Tom's did. And for a little while, you know, he had moved into this new law office, and folks around town called it the Maxwell House because they felt like, you know, it was Maxwell's insurance money that was helping him do so well. So his reputation became quite fraught. And, you know, Big Tom died before I started working on this book, and I hope we're about to get into what happened to the Reverend Maxwell. So I wasn't able to ask either of them about their friendship, but certainly he provided, you know, 7 years worth of legal representation in some very dicey cases.
Well, Reverend Maxwell ends up meeting his fate at the hands of really street justice. Can you kind of explain what happened there?
Yeah, so in 1977, at the funeral of his last alleged victim, a 16-year-old stepdaughter, the Reverend was in the funeral home, and the service was about to end, and kind of dramatically, in front of 300 people, someone got up with a gun and shot him 3 times in the head. So it was pure vigilante justice, and almost immediately that man was arrested by the police in Alexander City, and he made 2 confessions, one in the funeral home, one on the way to the police station, and just said, you know, I had to do it, and if I had to do it again, I would. And he was related to the stepdaughter whose funeral it was, and he was truly worried about other relatives because, you know, he felt like you didn't know who was going to be next. And like a lot of people around this part of Alabama, he was truly afraid. And I think, you know, we were talking about Big Tom's motives and, you know, his attitude towards casework. I think what's most interesting is that almost immediately he takes the case of the vigilante who murdered his former client. So part of the reason Big Tom is such a huge character in my book is he is a through line from the original suspicious death to the trial of the vigilante. And in fact, he defends him in the fall of 77 at this kind of sensational two-day trial around Lake Martin.
Well, and this trial was the trial of Robert Burns for killing Willie Maxwell, but it attracts attention. It attracted the attention of Harper Lee, who was coming off of having observed the Hickok and Perry murders down in Kansas. But Harper Lee is from Alabama, and she's in the courtroom watching this. It's only a two-day trial, so it's not a huge event for her, but can you explain why it was so important for her to, at this point in her life, to go down there and observe this and to hopefully write about it?
Sure. I mean, one thing to say about trial law at the time is actually a two-day trial was a really long one, especially in this part of Alabama. So, you know, often these things were settled in a matter of hours and the jury didn't deliberate very long, but this was a trial that went on for 2 days that had, you know, quite a few witnesses and, you know, was covered voraciously by the press in the area and covered in the Post and covered in Newsweek. And, you know, there was media attention from around the country. And Harper Lee shows up. She actually got a niece who lives in town. His husband owns a motel. So she's got some family connections there. But I think you're right to bring up In Cold Blood because it seems like what drew her to this case was the opportunity, you know, from this trial on, to really deeply report a true crime story and to interview people who knew the victims and to interview lawyers and law enforcement officers and to get all of the evidence and materials that allow you to tell a deep story about crime and justice. And so in her case, you know, she's there for the 2 days and then she buys a copy of the transcript and she interviews Robert Burns and she interviews Tom Radney and she interviews their families. And, you know, she just goes around town. She's there for over 9 months, almost a year, and does a tremendous amount of reporting and really does the kind of deep reporting where, you know, she's looking into the history of the region. She's very interested in the Creek Wars, and there was a very pivotal battle near this part of Alabama, so she seemed to have wanted to incorporate that into the book. But she just does a lot of reporting and research, and by all accounts, you know, we know from correspondence in the year, that year, 77, all the way into the 80s, she's planning to write a book about it. And, you know, she's writing to Gregory Peck to say how it's going. And, you know, she brings down a friend from New York to visit her and see the setting of the book. And, you know, just all signs point to full steam ahead because, as you say, by 1977, it's 17 years after Mockingbird, she really has something to prove. And she doesn't want to be a one-hit wonder. And she really wants to write another book.
And part of the mystery of this is that book is nowhere to be found other than a first chapter, right?
Yeah, so there's a little bit, you know, obviously we've got a lot of her correspondence. There's this four pages of draft material. There's a page of her notes when she was interviewing the sister of the first Mrs. Maxwell. And, you know, of course, there's this tremendous, you know, kind of oral history around Alex City of all these folks she talked to who she would say things like, oh, I'm nearly finished. I'm just trying to figure out how it ends. Or, you know, oh, you know, it's on its way to the printers. So from the 80s on, there's just been this appetite and energy around Lake Martin for when is this Harper Lee book going to come out. And, of course, it was bittersweet for those folks when Ghost at a Watchman was announced in 2015 because they thought it was going to be the book about the Reverend. And they have just been, you know, waiting and wondering about what happens. And, again, I hope one of the things people like about Furious Hours is the opportunity to kind of dwell in the space of did she write it or not, and if she did she destroy it? Because she was one of these writers who was known to get rid of manuscripts she didn't think were up to snuff. And if she didn't destroy it, what happened to it? Because there's a whole, you know, school of rumor around this part of Alabama that she wrote it and the publisher rejected it, or she wrote it and she was afraid of the Reverend's living accomplices, so she didn't want to publish it. So it really is a mystery what happened to the manuscript if, in fact, he wrote it.
Well, this book is just fantastic the way you put it together. It's so shrouded in mystery, and even by the time you're done with it, there's still questions that we'll have. And so I guess the way that you've put this together, we know as much as we can possibly know now. And I'm not going to spoil it, but there is a little tidbit in there about a Christmas gift that Harper Lee received that changed the course of literary history as we know it forever. But this book is Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee by Casey Sepp. It is available now wherever your fine books are sold. You pick this up if you like anything about mystery, literature. It's got so much in here. Casey, just a fantastic book here. Thanks for putting it out so we can learn from it. And thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Song, song of the South, sweet potato pie and a shut my mouth.